Well, good evening. It's good to see everybody. We're glad you're here. Thank you for your attendance this week. I know, again, you're tired at times from getting off work, and so many people have to work far away from just this area, so I'm aware of that. And all of you young ladies that bring your kids and the young men and the fathers of those families, I thank you for making those efforts. We want to talk about a lesson this night about raising them right. You know the proverb. Proverbs 22:6, if you train up a child in the way he should go, when he is old, he will not depart from it. I was in a bookstore, I think it was probably Mardell's, and I found a little bitty book. And I like little bitty books. They either are going to be good or bad. That's true, of course, of every book. But a little book, they've got to say it, and they've got to get to the point. And Lakita Garth was the author of this book. I didn't know anything about her. I've learned a few more things about her since then. But the titles are sometimes what captures me. Sometimes the contents of the book, I just look at those pages because I think, boy, those are sermon outlines. Those would be good things to work on and think about what the Bible's saying. Well, her title of her book was The Naked Truth. Anybody that is concerned about truth and cares that there is an ultimate truth that we need to abide by, those kind of book titles are going to capture me. But then to put that very obvious word in front of it, The Naked Truth. And then at the subtitle, it was about, of course, things that pertain to sexual issues, the gender issues, all of those kinds of things. When I opened the book and began to read it, it was just chock full of really good advice, because it came from a heart of a woman that grew up in the ghetto. And her advice mirrored the Bible's because of her mother. She had a mother that raised her and four brothers as a single mom who never remarried. Her dad died of cancer when she was 11 years old. He had been in the Air Force for 27 years. He had fought in World War II in Korea and Vietnam. The doctors believe his cancer had come from Agent Orange, and she goes through all that story. But then she begins to tell certain things that just began to stand out. And they stand out because they are Bible truths. Impressionable minds live up to the expectations placed on them. You and I realize that we are given children by God, and yet those minds can be taken by somebody. For instance, can you imagine the trepidation that Moses' mother had when she realized her son was going to be raised in Pharaoh's household? But you think about the power that a mother can have in, I don't know how long she nursed Moses. Later in the Maccabean literature and in some cultures, you know that babies can be nursed into a young childhood. And the Maccabean literature points that out, that maybe the Hebrews were like that, that even up to 3 and 4 years old, or maybe even 5. But whether she had him for that length of time or not, she made such an impact on that little mind that even though Moses was put into a pagan home, his words were mighty indeed, and in words in Pharaoh's house, there's no telling what he accomplished. There's no telling what he did in those years that he grew up as a young man at the very pinnacle of the most powerful nation at the time. And yet it never took over in the very bottom core of him what his mama had put in his heart. She raised him, she nursed him, and you know that story. Impressionable minds live up to the expectations that we place on them. The Bible says to us in Proverbs 23, beginning at verse 22, "Listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she is old." You know that the Proverbs were probably written to the ruling class, that is, the princes, the king's sons and nephews that are going to rule the kingdom. Because he, remember, you'll read sometimes of one particular king, it said he gave to the eldest, he gave to the firstborn the kingdom, but to his brothers he gave cities. And so we know that they were instructed. Daniel and his three friends were of that ruling class. And so these are kids. Yeah, they're kids or young men, we may say, but they're able to hear, they're able to think. They're able to apply what is being said to them. And so maybe it's teenagers. Maybe that's the age group. But we're not talking. I mean, even little kids can comprehend this. But it's especially true that you have to be able to comprehend this. Listen to your father who gave you life, and do not despise your mother when she is old. Buy truth and do not sell it. Buy wisdom, instruction, understanding. You know how we lift that verse out? We lift verse 23 out because a lot of Proverbs are like that. They're just single couplets, and it's hard to read the Proverbs and remember what you read in the beginning when you were reading it. But if you just lift that out, you're missing the context, because in this part of the Proverbs, you've got some verses that are surrounding that. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice. He who fathers a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and mother be glad. Let her who bore you rejoice. My son, give me your heart and let your eyes observe my ways. Who's teaching the truth? Who's imparting the truth that you're not to buy it, or rather sell it? You're to buy wisdom instruction. You're to buy into it. Sometimes we say those kinds of phrases to our kids. You have to buy into the hermeneutic. That is how we understand the Bible. Because some people can come to it and just be willy-nilly about what they think and how they approach the Bible. But you need to understand how Jesus approaches it. Sometimes read Matthew 22 and ask yourself, what are the ways he is teaching the Sadducees in that story? You may not believe in necessary inference, but I don't care what you call it. You're going to get a necessary inference jam-packed in Matthew 22. You're going to get it in the story of Acts 9 when Peter says I've not eaten anything uncommon or unclean. I thought he let a sheet down that had all kinds of four-footed beasts. It says all kinds of four-footed beasts. But here's the reality of that. If you don't believe in necessary inference, that text doesn't make any sense, because it's all kinds of unclean animals are on that sheet. If there had been one clean animal out there, couldn't he have done it? If he saw it, couldn't he have done it? I thought it said all kinds were on it. Yeah, all kinds, but by necessary inference, unclean. Because he said, I can't do that. I can't go obey it. So if you come to a day and age as a young person and you say, I don't buy into that hermeneutic, I don't believe that, you need to study the Bible more. I don't care what you call it. Call it what you want. The concept is there. And what the generations that are before you are teaching you, give me your heart, son. Give me your heart and let your eyes observe my ways. And so Lakita goes on to talk about in that book, if we don't raise our children right the first time, we'll end up raising them the rest of our lives. Boy, I've watched that. Have you watched families that didn't have the guts to rear them right the first time, spent the rest of their life mopping up messes, constantly, even to the point of bailing out kids of jail, of just all kinds of things that you can imagine? Sometimes it's not the parents' entire fault, obviously, but many times where we need to focus our attention is on the parents. Lakita makes this point in her story. She said, my mama had rules, and one of those rules was be in the house when the streetlights come on. She said to this day, when she goes to a neighborhood without streetlights, she wonders how the kids know when to come home. In my neighborhood, she said, there were bullets and drug dealers and other bad things that happened in the dark, and mama loved us, and she enforced that rule. If we don't raise our children right the first time, we'll end up raising them the rest of our lives. Mama demanded good grades, she said, and she got them. When she went to a teacher's meeting, she asked our teachers to assign us extra homework. They did not like their mama when they were young. As teens, they thought she was old-fashioned, out of touch, clueless, and it's amazing her transformation in just a few short years, how wise she became. She was a strict disciplinarian. She'd drive the streets, she said, looking for us if we didn't follow the streetlight rule. Mrs. Garth's friends called her the warden. One Thanksgiving, her four brothers and Lakita were grown, and they started reminiscing about the kids they had grown up with. Mookie and Tyrone were high school All-Americans, wrestler and baseball player. Today, they're both crackheads. Their brains are fried. Next door to Mookie and Tyrone was an amazing baseball player named Shaquille. Instead of making the big time today, he's a drug lord. One of his employees shot a guy who lived behind Lakita's house, Kenny, execution style, because he wasn't paying his drug bill. Kenny's brother, Boyd, was on parole for running a prostitution ring. Gail, one of Boyd's girls, lived across the street from Lakita. She died of AIDS. Sherry lived next door to Gail, and in her eighth month of pregnancy, she OD'd, killing herself and her baby. And then the quote from the book. On that Thanksgiving afternoon, we went down the street in our conversation. We went through name after name, face after face, and house after house, and most of the kids we grew up with had either disappeared or been incarcerated or were living on government assistance or had been found dead. We replayed everyone's life, and that's when we realized that we were the only complete family to make it out of that neighborhood. There were other people who made it out, but there was not one single other house that didn't have at least one of those terrible stories like the ones I just told. Lakita's brothers, Kevin is an anesthesiologist, Leon is a lawyer, Mark an engineer, David a retired military, and Lakita is president and CEO of her company. So they asked themselves the question, why did we make it out? Why did this house make it out of that neighborhood? Smarter than everyone else? More money? Nothing that. Government assistance? Nope. But sitting at that table that day, she realized and they realized that there were three things, and that's what I want to preach to you tonight, because they are all Bible that their mama taught them. And the first of those is very plain. Children need God-fearing parents. They need a visible parent to instill in them the fear in the invisible God. She can remember her mother at times when they would teach principles about the Bible, that she would pace the floor, according to Lakita, like General Patton, and say, I may not be able to see everything you do or hear everything you say, but God is watching. And everything you do, God is writing in a book. Where did she get that from? She got it by reading the Bible. God is indeed writing our names in a book. Sometimes we get away from some of these most basic concepts. I can remember growing up listening to that sort of thing, hearing people preach about the book that God keeps our name written in. In Revelation chapter 20, verse 12, and then at verse 15, I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Somebody might say to me, well, there's a lot of figurative language in Revelation. How do you know that that's really a reality? I'm going to tell you, listen to the Apostle Paul. You have John writing Revelation, Paul writing Philippians. There's no figurative language in this passage. Yes, I ask you also, true companion, help these women who have labored side by side with me in the gospel together with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in. And he calls the same thing that John did, the book of life. That is that God is keeping, as we might think in terms of it, a record of who we are and what we are doing. And there are a number of passages that say to us, we're going to be judged according to our deeds. Now, you can make fun of that or belittle it or ignore it, but you'll do so to your peril. Lakita's mama believed it. And that's what she taught to her kids. God does see and judge what we are doing. And that family believed that. And that's why they made it out of that neighborhood. God is seeing and judging every last one of us. Now, I need to say something to you here. I think sometimes we may center on this and forget that at the end of time, I'm going to need grace. When I stand before God in the day of judgment, I'm going to need his grace. There's no way that I can perfectly keep. That's what got me in trouble to begin with. It's what got you in trouble to begin with. But that doesn't mean you don't try. That doesn't mean that you sort of slack up and say, I don't need to fear God and strive with every ounce of my ability. There's too many passages. And if you thought about the Apostle Paul and just his life alone, it would put us all to shame. Or Jesus, we would want to live to that standard. But the Bible talks about God seeing us and that we'll have to give an account to him. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of soul and spirits, of joints and marrow, and discerns the thoughts and the intention of the heart. Are you ever reading your Bible? There are times when I'm preparing a lesson and I'm reading a passage and I'm thinking about it. And folks, I come to tears. There are times that I come to tears. I'm speaking metaphorically, I'm speaking really, in reality. Because if you are touched by what God is saying, if you realize that sword pierces to the division of soul and spirit and just rips us apart because we know we are guilty of that, then follow it with verse 13. No creature is hidden from his sight, but all are naked and exposed to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. And then you read Paul's statement in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. The one who died in order that we might not perish in hell in our sins is the one we will stand before. Him, Christ, his judgment seat to give an account for what we have done in our body. King David can imagine as Nathan is telling him that story, and there is that good conscience in David, but he has almost seared it. He has gone against it, and for over a year he did that. Well, that baby grew and then finally perished at this juncture. But you remember when Nathan tells that parable, David said, "That man ought to die." And at that moment, Nathan had him. He said, "Thou art the man." I still love the old King James. I just can't say it any other way. Thou art the man. And David didn't make excuses like King Saul. It pierced him to his heart. The good man that he was came back and he said, "I have sinned." And God had put away his sin, but the consequences were going to haunt him the rest of his days. And so when mama wasn't around, when our parents aren't around, God will take over. She tells a story in the book at a drugstore with our neighborhood buddies. We had our measly change that we had collected by finding pennies or something on the ground or behind the couch. We didn't have an allowance, she said. She told the story about one of her brothers was brave enough to ask her dad when he was alive, "Why we don't get an allowance like other kids." He said, "You get an allowance. I'll allow you to eat my food and watch my TV and live in this house." But the friend urged them to steal some candy because nobody would know. And she said, "Me and my brothers looked at them and shook our head and said, 'No, sir, we know God is watching and he'll tell mama.'" You know the passage, don't you, that begins the book of Proverbs? Turn with me to chapter 1 and think with me about this powerful text that he said begins by talking to the sons. Those that will rule, hear, my son, your father's instruction. Forsake not your mother's teaching, for they are a graceful garland for your head and pendants for your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, "Come with us, let us lie in wait for blood. Let us ambush the innocent without reason. Like Sheol, let us swallow them alive, who's like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods. We shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us. We will all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Hold back your foot from their paths, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. For in vain is a net spread in the sight of any bird, but these men lie in wait for their own blood. They set an ambush for their own lives. Such are the ways of everyone who is greedy for unjust gain. It takes away the life of its possessors." You know what he wants you to do, young person? He wants you to always ask what mama and daddy said and to look down that road. Look down that road. If your friends are saying to you, "Do this with us, go with us," look down that road and ask the question, where does that end up? Where does that road go? Because so many times people just look with what is right in front of them and they're not thinking about that. One time when Jonathan, my son, was 6, 7, I don't remember, we were driving to school and he asked me a question like that. Some kids had wanted him to do a bad thing and I thought, boy, this is one of those teaching moments, you know. So I'm telling him about Proverbs 1. I'm just referring to some of the phrases that are in it, and I'm talking to him and telling him how you're not to go with them, don't throw your lot in with them, listen to your father and mother. And I get to the end of it, and Jonathan just barks out and he says, "Yeah, Dad, we need to punch their lights out." And I thought, well, yeah, there's another lesson. We've got to go to another passage and talk about how that's not the right thing to do. Parents, need to be engaged in their lives. Secondly, that's our point. Don't be afraid to parent. The disastrous tale of disrespect and disobedience among young people is becoming worse and worse. We were talking tonight, some of the young guys that I was eating with, and they were talking about how their wives, as being school teachers, are experiencing sometimes at the levels of just the elementary school, just terrible, terrible stories of insubordination, of not being submissive, of parents. It's the parents that so many times are the ones that are the problem. And I told Travis, it was his night to be on the meal list, and I said, I have preached this lesson before, and in my notes there's a story about Lacey Starling. And the story about Lacey is she started teaching math at Bryan High School. And if any of you all know about College Station and Bryan, Bryan's going to have some of the kids that come from the kind of thing that Lakita grew up in. And so I remember Lacey telling this story that she told her students to be quiet and stop talking, and they all started barking like dogs. Folks, if I had done that, not only would my mama have found out, my daddy would have found out, and you would not have a preacher at this gospel meeting, for I would have ceased to exist a long time ago. Now, I would have been, I can't even imagine what would have been done to me. But that's the reality of where lots of teachers find themselves. I say to about teachers in the public school system, you're on the front line of what's happening in society. You're on the front line of what's happening in homes, what's going on in our culture. You're seeing it at the gut level. And folks, disastrous tales of disrespect and disobedience are going on today, but they've always gone on for the same reason. Do you remember 1 Kings chapter 1 and verse 6 of Adonijah, who was the son that should have, by that time, apparently Chileab has died. And of course, Absalom has been killed. He killed Amnon. And so who's next in line? Not Solomon, Adonijah. And Adonijah, of course, sets himself up to try to take control of the kingdom. And it says of David, his father had never at any time displeased, the English Standard says, I love the New King James better, he had never rebuked him by saying, why have you done this? And so, I'll tell you, fathers, our business is to look at our kids and say, why'd you do that? That if we're not doing that, we are forsaking the duty that God gave us as parents, and mamas need to follow that suit too. But his father never did. As good a man as David was, he was a failure as a father. I preach a lesson about three different fathers that failed kids. David, though he was a man after God's heart, failed his family again and again. And this caused Adonijah to develop an attitude that led to his own death at the hand of his brother Solomon. Or what about the story that is told of Eli and those wicked sons? How did Eli let that happen? Sometimes I look at stories like that and I think, Eli, God said to you, you could have stopped this. And I'm going to tell you, he could have. If it meant even, folks, that he had to say, my sons are worthy to be taken out and stoned to death, they were. God killed them anyway because of their unbelievable ungodliness. But you can stop. I understand your kids go outside of your control and when they move and they're on their own and all that. But I'm going to say to you, you can stop a lot of it. Why do you scorn my sacrifices? He sent an unnamed prophet to Eli. Remember, they were taking the best. They would, before an offerer could offer it, they'd take the best for themselves. The best was to go to God. Why do you scorn my sacrifices and my offering that I command for my dwelling and honor your sons above me, by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Folks, there's going to be more people that go to hell among God's people for this passage, that you honor your children more than you honor God. And God will never take second place, ever. And if you honor your kids, or if kids honor their parents or whoever, in other words, you continue to deal with them in some way that says it doesn't matter how bad your lifestyle is, we're just not going to make it a big deal in our family. Someday God is going to, you're going to stand before his throne, and do you think you're going to hear what this unnamed prophet was sent to tell Eli? That you can honor your children more than you honor God. Don't be afraid to be a parent. Do you remember the passage that is in 2 Kings 2 concerning Elisha? And Elisha was going up, and he went up from there to Bethel. And we'll talk about what Bethel is in a minute. And while he was going up on the way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, mocked him, some versions say, that kind of thing, saying, "Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head." So don't ever do that to somebody. I didn't mean to look at you, Todd. And he turned around, and when he saw them, he cursed them in the name of Yahweh, in the name of the Lord. Remember who Elisha is? Elisha was the one that Elijah anointed as prophet of God in his place. He is the direct spokesman for God to this evil generation. And two she-bears came out of the woods and tore the New King James better, mauled 42 of the boys. Now I'm going to tell you, every time somebody studies that passage, they have all kinds of problems about God and everybody else, about Elisha. But I'm going to tell you what's going on here. Where was Bethel? What was Bethel? Do you remember when Jeroboam became king and he began to realize that the people in the north would go back to Jerusalem for the three feasts that God called all males to go back to? And he realized he could lose his kingdom. So he set up a golden calf at Dan in the north, and Bethel was at his southern border, just a few miles from Jerusalem. And he said, "Behold, Israel, your gods that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt. And he made that golden calf much represent of what happened to Moses in the wilderness. That became not a false god in the sense that he's going after Baal. He's saying, "This is the God." But it's a false god. God said, "Never make an image of me in anything." And the people he made priests of any tribe that wanted to be, and you know that sorry story. That's Bethel. Now, fast forward two centuries. We're 200 years in the future, and imagine what the attitude was toward Yahweh's prophets and the real God. Folks, can you imagine? It's not just 42 boys that come out. The bears mauled 42 boys. But more boys than 42 went out. Somebody said, "They're just boys." Yeah, if I study the Hebrew right, I'm thinking they're about 10. They couldn't have been any more than 10, 12 years old. Can you imagine a neighborhood that a prophet of God, known prophet of God, comes by? They know who he is. And they rush out, more than 42 boys. Was it 100? 150. If I saw that many kids coming at me that are 10 or 12, would you think be afraid for your life, maybe? Did y'all see what Antifa the other day, that sorry organization? Did y'all see them? They harassed an elderly lady as she was going across a crosswalk. What happens in a society that begins to break down? Law and order and all kinds of other respect for authority, respect for policemen, respect for teachers, respect for law, all begin to go by the wayside. And the chaos that comes, it's just whoever has the fastest gun and the biggest amount of it. Men in Philippines, that you go over there and talk to them that are brethren, they say the three G's rule over here: guns, gold, and goons. And whoever has the most of them is the one that rules. That's what happens in a society that goes down and down and down. A society that doesn't respect God. Where were the parents of these 42 boys? What had they taught them about respecting the elderly? About rising up before the hoary head? Every now and then, I'll go, when I was in College Station, I'd walk up to a group of young people and there'd be one guy would stand up. I'd say, your mom and daddy taught you right. Because he understood. I didn't expect them all to stand up. But I just mean, it said something. Folks, where were these kiddos' parents that allowed such a deterioration to happen that they would treat somebody that way? And so when Elisha turns around and curses them in the name of the Lord, it is because they have cursed God. If you're God's spokesman, you come in the name of God, God's being cursed. And God will never have any, he will never have anything to do with that except judgment. This is not a story about little bitty boys that didn't know what they were doing. It is about parents that had disastrously failed their family. Lakita tells a story of coming out of one of her presentations on abstinence. That's what her corporation does. She goes around trying to help kids do the right thing at a Kentucky school, and she saw a girl cussing out her mother. Lakita walked up to her and said to the girl, "Do you eat out of that same dirty mouth you just talked out of?" The mother looked at her and sadly whined. "She talks to me like this all the time." Lakita said, "I wanted to backhand the mother, not the girl." The girl said to Lakita, with her hands on her hips and her head cocked to one side, she said, "You ain't my mama." Lakita replied, said, "I ain't your dentist either, but if you talk to me one more time like that, I'll snatch every tooth out of your mouth." Folks, God means business. The day of judgment's coming. And he'll have nothing to do with those who do not have the courage to do what needs to be done. Parents are needed who are not afraid to spank their children. In Proverbs, there are the passages you know that use the word rod. Whoever spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. Or this passage, Proverbs 22:15, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. I've had young people of the current generations, right, past younger than me, argue that the rod is metaphorical here, that there's many ways to discipline a child. And I understand that. There are many ways. You take cell phone privileges away. You take computer time away. Their gaming privileges. I mean, there's a lot of ways to discipline. I understand that. But what they're trying to say to me, in effect, is that this does not talk about spanking. What do you do with a passage like this one? Proverbs 23:13-14. Do not withhold discipline from a child, for if you strike him with a rod, he will not die. Does that sound metaphorical? Because if the strike with the rod is metaphorical, so is the he will not die. They both have to go together. He means that if you whip your child, if you spank your child, you're not going to kill him. We're not talking about abuse. We're not talking about doing the wrong thing here. We're talking about what all of us grew up with and understood when they were my age and younger. We understood that we were going to get a paddling from our parents if we misbehaved. If you strike him with a rod, you will save his soul from Sheol. I fear that even present-day young families who are Christians are not following this advice from heaven. Listen to me carefully. Do you know more than God? Argue with me on Proverbs 23:13-14 that that's not a literal rod. Argue with me that God is not saying that you are to spank your children. Do you know more than the generations, young people, the generations that have come before you, the generations that have done those things? And in your 20s and 30s or 40s, have you become all wise and need no counsel about what ought to be done? Lakita's mother said, "I'm your mother," when she would spank their kids. "I love you no matter what you think right now," in the minister of punishment. I remember my dad saying to me, "This is going to hurt me more than it does you." I wanted to say to him, "Well, then let me have the paddle, and I'll you know." But I knew I would. Well, you wouldn't have had a preacher for the gospel meeting. And after she had spanked them, she would take them in her arms and hug them, and she would say to them, "I'm not trying to win a popularity contest. My job is to be your parent, not your friend." You know where friendship comes? It comes when you grow up. And when you come to them and you seek their advice, and they know you have your own home and they treat you with respect, but they become your confidants. They become the counselors and the wisdom that they still share. And we understand how important that is. You can tell the difference between parents who have trained their children and not just raised them. My dad used to say, anybody can raise kids. You raise chickens, pigs, horses, and cows with minimal requirements for caring for the animal. Give them a safe place and feed and water. But rearing children is a lot more than that. And yet, there are many parents that the latest designer clothes, the latest cell phones, unrestricted access to TV and the internet, but there are no parents. Training requires self-sacrifice and service and love and discipline, in short, agape love. In turn, such young people learn to respect themselves and respect their parents and respect other adults. Folks, we take little ones when they're old, when they're young. If we didn't, they'd never take baths, they'd never brush their teeth, they'd smell to high heaven and all their teeth would rot out. We make them do those things, don't we? And yet, when it comes to spiritual things, do we somehow slip a cog and not realize you're going to go to church, you're going to study the Bible? There's a point in there where we have to do that sort of thing. We bend the tree as they get older, but at some point it's like bonsai trees. You can't bend it anymore or you'll break the limb. When Jonathan, my son, was young and I was trying to teach him about yes sir, no sir, when we said those things, our family, no ma'am, all those things to be respectful. You love hearing it when it comes back from teachers and they tell you at school about your kiddos, don't they? Boy, you think, well, you know, the stuff we did, the hard stuff we did, settled in and took hold. And so he wanted a drink of water, and he came in there in his pajamas, and I was handing him the glass of water, and before I handed it to him, I said, what do you say? And he bowed his head and said, Father in heaven, thank you for this water. And I said, that's good enough. Yeah. I mean, you get it somewhere. And finally, the third point that she made in her book is this: parents teach abstinence. Every right, she said, demands responsibility. Every right that God gives us, that's true, is it not? Demands responsibility. If we wait until we're married, God gives the great blessings of the sexual relationship. But when you decide to do what so many in this country do, then it is a mess, and we're watching it. Do you realize there are certain groups in this country that 2/3 of the babies that are born to certain groups in this country are born out of wedlock? You imagine across the board in America, it doesn't matter what race, what color, creed, whatever, 40% of babies are born out of wedlock. What do you think that's going to translate into in this century as decades go by? Lakita's mama never slept with any man. She said, I slept with 3 men, your daddy, and Smith and Wesson. I never slept with any man. They never saw a string of boyfriends come into their house. They never saw her stray from that. She never remarried. And this is what she said as a result of that. If you're not modeling what you're teaching something else. She lived it. Because she lived it before them. Abstinence is the means to reach the end that is a deep and lasting love of a lifelong relationship. At the end of her book, she tells a story about her granddad, who had been married, I think, 65 years to her grandmother when she died. And he said every day he takes his folding chair and he walks about a mile from the house and he sets it down by my grandmama's grave. And he sits there for hours and talks about their 8 kids to her, as it were, and talks about their grandkids. Because a love that was so deep and abiding, Lakita's mama came from somewhere, that we pass it on. We teach them by who we are. Do you want to live with no regrets? With parents, we're going to regret. But we will never regret the hard stuff we had to do to shape our children, no matter how hard it was to do it. But we will always live to regret children that we keep having to rear in adulthood. Be biblical parents. Learn from the mistakes that are set forth by David and others. Learn the positive, uplifting examples, both in modern times and especially from the Bible. Andy Stanley made this point, a clear picture of what could be driven by a deep passion that it should be. That is vision. It doesn't matter if we're elders or our life as a Christian. It is understanding that we have to have a clear picture of point A to point B. Where are we going? I was with Travis tonight and he said that Leah was 6 years old. And I said, I used to say to all you guys, you got three sixes. Three sixes. And that's all you have. That first 6 years is already gone with him. He can't imagine how fast that next 6 years is going to go. And then it's just a blink. And they're gone. They're on their own. We get one shot at this, parents. We get one shot. And we must do it right. Because you'll clean up a mess the rest of your days. Not only a clear picture of what can be, but driven by a deep passion that it should be. And let's make it happen. Subject to heaven's invitation, tonight Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you come back to him in any way, we bid you do so as together we stand and sing.